Hello, and welcome to Parenting Help with Vigeo Behavior Consulting. Join us for conversations with experts in the fields of cognitive behavior, mental health, behavior analysis, education, and child psychology. On this podcast, we examine the challenges that parents are facing and share insights and strategies that have helped other parents with similar issues. I'm your host, Katie Palmer. I'm a parenting coach and board-certified behavior analyst. I'm also the owner of Vigeo Behavior Consulting. I am fortunate to be able to engage in conversations with some incredible professionals whose depth and breadth of experience can offer guidance for parents who are looking for new ideas. I hope you find this podcast useful, engaging, and insightful. I am really excited to welcome Dr. Allison Stapleton to this podcast. Dr. Stapleton is someone who I have followed, whose work I have followed, who has helped us in many ways, both at Two Roads Academy and my learning across my journey of understanding psychological flexibility and rigidities and how people suffer in their lives. So welcome, Dr. Stapleton, and could you introduce yourself to our audience and share a little bit about your journey to where you are today?
Hi, everyone. I think it's really important for me to be clear about my experience because I think Ireland differs somewhat from the States. So I completed a research PhD here in Ireland on the topic of adolescent rule following. And although I do have experience in applied settings, I'm not a clinical psychologist. So a lot of what I'll say will come from theory and available research. But at the end of the day, parents know their children, and I can say what relational frame theory says, but it's actually about checking then on an individual basis whether that's helpful or an unhelpful way of looking at things.
That's really great context. Thank you. And it's a wonderful prompt for all of us to take what we hear and apply it with sensitivity to the context that we're in. So I'd like to start with this question of rule-governed behavior. What do we mean when we talk about rule-governed behavior?
I think in everyday contexts, when we use the word rules, we tend to think of if-thens. So if I work hard, then I'll be successful. Or if you clean your room, then you can go out and play. We also tend to think of rules as being given by other people. So a teacher's rule for the classroom, a parent's rules for their child, children's rules in games, or indeed another piece here in that sample of rules that I've provided so far is that we tend to think of rules as stating a consequence. So if you clean your room, then you can access this consequence of going outside to play. And with relational frame theory or RFT, that concept of rules is much broader. So from an RFT perspective, rules might not be presented as an if-then. Rules might not state a consequence. From an RFT perspective, rules are verbal statements about events in the world that influence behavior. So it's things that we say that are likely to change what we do. And how we interact with the world around us. And these rules might come from ourselves or others. So we can even break this down a bit with an example, because as I'm saying it, I'm realizing, wow, this is a lot of jargon. But we could say, let's, for example, say I have a statement like, I am socially awkward. For me, that could be a rule, because saying it to myself might actually change the way that I interact with others. So I might be more likely to avoid social situations, or I might even attempt to overcompensate for potential awkwardness to the point of burnout.
Oh, right. And I've heard of that idea of social batteries, where is that sort of like draining one's social battery might be an attempt to, after an attempt to counter that rule. Is that sort of the idea there?
Yeah, it could be. So if that is my rule, and my rule is I'm socially awkward, I have to work extra hard to not appear socially awkward because there are consequences associated with being socially awkward that I don't want. I might push myself even harder than my capacity would allow. And that could actually be detrimental for my well-being, but it could also negatively impact on those social connections that I'm trying to foster. So there's a lot of complex behaviors that might show up in that context of rule following.
Yeah. And I think about what you said a moment ago, where, you know, in RFT, there may not be a consequence stated in the rule. It may not show up as an if then. If I'm socially awkward, then. So if we are constructing rules that we have not necessarily thought about the consequence, or have we encountered what happens after we follow the rule? Can you speak a little bit to that distinction, where a rule might show up and it doesn't sound like a rule, it sounds more like a description?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really key to RFT. So we're not as interested so much in what people are saying per se, but rather how they're understanding the way that the world works. So, you know, if you ask me what my rule is, ideally in a more straightforward way for me to answer, but if you were to ask me and I said, oh, I'm socially awkward, that might not look like a rule when I say it. But the way I'm understanding my being socially awkward might mean that if I'm socially awkward, then I'm likely to have poorer social connections with others. And that's just one way that that rule could be understood. But something from that RFT perspective that I think is really valuable is the emphasis on the individual. So it's not just what are they saying, because two people could be saying the same thing and understanding it in totally different ways, and then responding and behaving in totally different ways. So it's really trying to pin down, what does this actually mean for this person? How are they understanding how this world works? And then how is that impacting on how they're likely to behave or what they're likely to do?
So many things are coming into my mind right now about some of the challenges that I hear from parents. And one of them might be a way of understanding their child that creates a rule for how parents behave. I might be leaping too far ahead in my own mind, but how do we, first of all, learn to recognize that we're following a rule, and then learn to understand whether it's working for us or whether it's problematic at all. That's a lot. I just handed you probably something that could turn into a thesis.
God, I don't want to do another thesis, but I have some thoughts here, and it is just really important for me to say before I share any of those thoughts that because of the broad definition of rule-governed behavior and some other kind of definitional problems in particular, there is not much research available on rule-governed behavior, even in terms of how we identify it, how do we know if it's causing a problem, or even how we might intervene if we notice that a rule is problematic. So just holding all of that in mind as we're going through this. But in terms of what would make a rule problematic, I would say that problematic rule following is when someone is following a rule, even though they've gotten a consequence that they don't want as a result of following that rule, or even if they've failed to get the outcome that they do want because they've followed that rule. So really what I'm saying there is that a problematic rule is an unworkable rule. And my own background would be in the ACT or acceptance and commitment therapy sphere. So when I say workable, I mean aligned with their values. So if following a rule is helping you to be the kind of person that you want to be in the long run, then that's working for you. And if following a rule is not helping you to be the kind of person that you want to be in the long run, then it's not working for you. And it's more likely to be a problematic rule.
I think about how to help people recognize the rule. There's so many examples sort of mushed around in my head right now that I'm struggling to find one that is clear. Here's a clear example. I need to get out and meet people. That is followed by a behavior of signing up for an activity. And as it turns out, that activity was not something that this person actually enjoys. But they thought, this is what I'm supposed to do to meet people. And so when we talk about workability, I like the way you framed that, because does it help them move toward their values or be the kind of person they want to be in the long run? While it does serve that value of connecting with people, it may pull this person away from the value of being their authentic self. If they're doing an activity that is not something they enjoy, but it's something they believe is in the service of connecting with people. And I see that as sort of a push and pull, or pulling in two different directions. And if I was to conceptualize that as, you know, problematic rule following, how might you guide someone to sort of understand what is happening behaviorally?
That's great. Great point. I think this is something I've been increasingly interested in, because I've been getting more and more interested in something called relational density theory, which is phenomenal and also a lot of jargon, so I won't get too much into it. But it's the idea that there are multiple consequences to all our actions. So there's always lots of different stuff happening at the same time. And so when we're trying to talk about whether something is working or not working for a person, it can be unhelpful to put it into concrete dichotomies, or it's either working or not working. It's like, okay, it's working in this sense, and it's also not working in this sense at the same time, because real life tends to be a lot messier than the neat definitions that we might see in the purple book or in theory books. So then the question becomes not, is it this or that? It becomes, is it more about moving towards the kind of person you want to be? Or is it more about avoiding those consequences that you don't want from others? And even language can give us some insight into this. So Matthew Villatt and colleagues tend to talk about rules in terms of, if you see someone saying should, must, or have to, that can indicate a rule that is likely controlled more by wanting to get away from a consequence that they don't want. Because the language itself is indicating that this might not be something that a person actually wants to do. You know, I should do this, I have to do this, in contrast with, you know, I get to do this, or I'm choosing to do these other behaviors that are aligned with the person I want to be.
I had a conversation just yesterday with a parent who had some ideas in his head about an event that he went through, where he recognized, these were not choices I wanted to make. These were not choices I should have made. We spent some time looking at not whether the choice was right or wrong, but where were the choice points, and trying to think about in any one of those choice points, how many different choices could you make and what would each of those paths look like? And I was reminded of that when you described the avoidance component that might show up with the shoulds and the needs to, how we might be almost chastising ourselves.
Yep, absolutely. I think even the concept of, you know, did I make the right decision or I made a wrong choice can be, I'm not sure if this is the right word, it might not be, I'll probably think of it when we finish recording this, but it's almost pathologizing our own decision making in ways that are unlikely to be helpful for us making decisions going forward. And I think there's another component here. Lately, I've been really interested in reading about safety behaviors. So things that we do to keep ourselves safe. And oftentimes things that we do to keep ourselves safe might look like turning away from our values. We might be a person who really values social connection, and also be someone who's feeling a lot of anxiety, and choose to opt out of going to our friend's party. And superficially, that might look like someone avoiding, but actually they could be replenishing their resources so that they've more fuel to pursue their values in the future at another point. So it's not always that a step away from one value cannot be a step towards another value. In this case, it could be that step towards self-care. So we always have those multiple consequences or multiple competing values. And I think that's another reason I really like the question to be, which is this behavior more about? Is it more about towards, or is it more about away? Because, you know, likely it's both to some degree at the same time.
And having that awareness of this moment, I'm in this moment and I'm choosing this toward a value over here, that the idea that values can be in conflict with each other, but sometimes, depending on the context we're in any given moment, we are thinking about how to prioritize the values that are important in the context that we're in.
I think the other thing relevant to this that we might not have named yet is when we talk about workability, you know, workable for who and says who.
That's brilliant. Okay.
And how do
workable
we know?
Workable for who?
Yeah, for who, says who, and how do I know? So from an ACT perspective and consistent with RFT, when we talk about living in line with your values and whether a behavior is working or not working, it's intended to be from the perspective of the individual. So their values, not the values that we might be projecting onto them. And workability is also meant to be something that is from their perspective. So it should be working for them, according to them. But it's also important to look at, how do we know it's working or not working? You know, what metric am I using? Am I saying that this behavior is helping me enact this value because, you know, my therapist or my parents told me it does, so therefore it's true? Because that's not likely to be a really meaningful sense of valued living if it's just, well, they said so, and that makes it true.
That sounds a lot like pliance to me.
Yeah.
Which is another bit of jargon that that I'm fond of using. This idea of either saying things that we believe other people want to hear, or will potentially get us what we want in the presence of certain others, regardless of whether that happens or whether we know that will happen, or just under that social pressure. It's almost a form of peer pressure. They said so, and so I have to do it this way. Rule following in that way, does it sometimes show up internally? Could you talk a little bit about those sort of like internal rules that are created, never stated by others, but we sort of infer a rule from something that we've learned or something that we hear?
I think that's relevant again to the topic of self-pliance, which is a little bit of jargon, but it's rules we have for ourselves that are about following a rule for the sake of following a rule. So we might have learned that doing as you're told works, and therefore it might look like we're doing all the things we're supposed to do, supposed to in quotes there, or we're living in line with our supposed values. But that might not be the case, because we might be doing those things because we've learned that doing as you're told is effective. And so it's not really about living in line with values in those cases. It's more about getting reinforcement from supposedly pleasing others, which can be really complex and complicated, of course, as well. But I think that that can be one of the reasons that it's helpful to always ask why. So why am I doing this thing that I'm doing? Is it about pleasing others? Is it because they told me to? Is it because this aligns with the kind of person that I want to be? Is it because I'm not sure why I'm doing it? I just am. And maybe that's an indicator that I need to take a pause. So, continually coming back to your why seems to be helpful.
And that's that process of self-reflection. And how do we, here's a question that parents often have, like, in the moment, my child is having a meltdown. My teenager is yelling at me, or I'm stressed because my teenager won't get out of bed and we're already half an hour late for school. And all of these emotions show up, and having the time for that self-reflection, why am I engaging in XYZ? Why am I threatening my child, even though that doesn't line up with my values? Why am I engaging in this sense of time pressure because there's a time that we're supposed to be at school? And I'm sort of coming up with potential rules that might be in people's head that create this high level of stress. Do you have any suggestions for people on how they can get to a place of slow down. Probably nothing's really on fire. Let me check in with myself and ask why.
I'm having a lot of thoughts here. I think I think parents have it really tough in general anyway. And I think, you know, maybe one of the last things that they need is someone like me lecturing them on here's what you can do to be a parent. And so I think the only thing I can say here that seems even, you know, loosely appropriate is that Dr. Sarah Cassidy, who I know that you know, and she's really just a phenomenal and really successful researcher and practitioner. But she had this quote that she used to say in some of her trainings, and it was about someone who had behaved in a way that they didn't like. And the question that she asked was, well, how could you do anything else? And so, you know, when the place is on fire in the morning and you're trying to get out the door on time, and you're maybe not behaving in ways that you want to, that makes total sense. How could you do anything else in that moment?
Yeah.
And I think even recognizing that and that little segue into self-compassion, I know I found that personally helpful. I don't know if parents would, but, you know, sometimes the house is on fire. And while it's on fire, you know, I can't pause and take this breath. I need to just get through this moment and then be nice to myself afterwards, because we aren't able to always be the kind of person that we want to be.
I'm always so drawn to that point of self-compassion. I think almost in every podcast episode so far, we have come back to it somehow. And so the fact that you mentioned it is lovely to me, because I believe it's so important for parents to recognize that being perfect, or even when they're working on improving, it's okay that it doesn't work all the time. And maybe that goes back to, you know, another rule about I have to be a good parent, which is a beautiful, deeply loving rule that may be kind of unattainable without self-compassion.
And even unpacking, you know, what is a good parent for me?
Yeah.
Like, what is my version of a good parent? And I think it's really important that parents are not striving for that unattainable perfection, but demonstrating that element of trying. You know, I'm having a really hard morning too, and I'm also trying to get to work on time, and this is really stressful for me also. And we're here together. We're going to get through it. We might not like when we look back at this moment, but we're here and we're going through it together.
I love that idea. We might not like, when we look back on this moment, we might not like the choices we made, and we're going to get through it together. That's a beautiful mantra. It sounds like a little bit like a mantra to me. Shifting gears only slightly and thinking about parents, and I have many, many folks come to me who've struggled with tantrums that their children are having that are so enormous, and how to navigate those. They may have created a world in which the whole family is walking on eggshells because a child might tantrum, or a parent might tantrum in ways that are unworkable for the family. I do find myself talking about boundaries and parents, trying to give permission for parents to set boundaries. And then I wonder, what is the difference between rules and boundaries? How might we understand when we're setting boundaries in a healthy way with our kids? How do we know?
And I think you're right when you talk about boundaries being really similar to rules. I'd even argue that because the definition of rules in accordance with RFT is so broad, boundaries could fall under that category of rules. And it's complicated to deal with boundaries effectively also, I think, because we want to, you know, in theory, we want to raise kids who are able to enact their personally chosen values. So the things that they care about. And at the same time, they're in a world with other people who are hopefully also trying to live in line with their values. And so it becomes a case of how can you live in line with your values in a world of other people doing the same thing without crashing into each other in ways that are, you know, likely to cause conflicts or problems for everyone involved. So it's a really complicated issue. And I think that it hasn't been looked at enough, even in terms of research, but I haven't seen that many clinical conceptualizations in accordance with ACT talking about that either. So, you know, when we want to instill pro-social values, respect for others, dignity, and self-advocacy, how can we keep people safe, have them, you know, do the things that they care about, but also not step on other people's values in the process?
Yeah, here in a little bit in what you're saying, I'm hearing a guideline potentially when parents want to set a boundary. That might be a lovely way to sort of examine, is this an overly rigid boundary? Am I curbing my child's growth and development and exploration? Or am I really, placing a rule around, you're crossing into stepping on other people's values and well-being and safety. And so I'm setting this boundary to help you learn that.
It feels a bit like a tightrope even to talk about it, because we never wanted to go too far the other way either, where someone is constantly prioritizing others' values, needs, preferences. There has to be that balance between both. And I, you know, maybe those conversations around boundaries between a parent and their child are the best arena to, you know, thrash out some of those concepts together. But also, I think, you know, again, parents have a lot going on. And I know that you are also really aware of times people might be chastising parents or criticizing parents in really unfair ways, when at the end of the day, they're just doing their best in a world that, you know, probably didn't equip them with those skills either to begin with. Yeah. So really complicated issue.
We talk a lot about, I sort of make the joke, because it's a bit of a painful joke, there is no manual, there's no handbook. You know, they hand you your child and they don't hand you the rule book or the here's how to do this. And we are all just trying to find our way and making mistakes and stumbling. And so many of the parents that I work with have children who might be described as neurodivergent, and sometimes the parents also express that they identify that way as well. I wonder if you could comment a little bit on how rules might show up differently or in a stronger way or not for that population.
I think it's really important to say from the onset, even though I know that you know this already, when we talk about rigid rule following or problematic rule following, sometimes people seem to assume that particular forms of neurodivergence are more likely to display that type of rule following. So for example, when people talk about, you know, autistic children or ADHDers, they tend to say that they have problematic rule following. But when we talk about problematic rule following, it's intended to be this universal experience that's not limited to one presentation or form of neurodivergence. So for example, you know, I might have rules around self-advocacy, like I don't deserve respect, or rules about emotional expression, like I shouldn't have these feelings, or even rules about productivity, you know, I'm not working hard enough. And these kinds of rules can show up in clinical and non-clinical populations. So they can show up regardless of someone's neurotype. And I think it was surprising for me the first few times I spoke about rule following outside of my little bubble, and noticed that, people think I'm talking exclusively about autistic experiences when I reference rigid rule following. And I think that was partly my own naivety. I didn't realize the lines that people might have been reading between that I hadn't intended.
Right.
But a lot of the way we think about rigid rule following among neurodivergent populations might be understood through the double empathy problem. So the way that we might say, oh, someone is being rigid, might instead mean that, you know, we ourselves are being rigid. What's wrong with what they're doing? We can't be chastising people for their level of rule following if we're displaying this exact same level of problematic rule following.
Right? Like I might have a different rule. Rigid about that, it maybe is in conflict with something I perceive as a rigidity in your behavior. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So if I'm doing something and your rule is don't do that thing, then those rules are in conflict. And it sometimes seems as if the person who is labeled as rigid more often tends to be a neuro minority. And in my experience, tends to be autistic, I've seen a lot of autistic people labeled as rigid rule followers. Again, even though that definition of rigid rule following just means doing something that's not working for you. And if you've gone your whole life without doing something that's not working for you, I'm shocked, because I think it
exactly.
was an experience.
we have all done that, you know, that like, let me try this again, because I believe it's going to work this time. Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. It's a wonderful way to pull back. And certainly for anyone who's listening, who might be a clinician or a practitioner using RFT or process-based ACT, recognizing that if we can look deeply at the components of the language and behavior and how they interact, then we can maybe more effectively step into other people's shoes and understand their experience as we are supporting them with things that they would like to change.
I think that's something that people talk about in the context of neuroaffirmative practices now as well. I've seen that more often, you know, recognizing that neurodivergence is not just a difference, but it can also be a strength and an asset. And it's not just about teaching someone to mask per se and follow rules about the kind of person that they should be in a given social context. It's also about strengthening their own culture. So, for example, in the case of autism, there's a really rich autistic culture. Particularly, I've seen online forums, and they're just so wonderfully supportive to each other. And there's really no reason to change the way that people are. And at the same time, we live in a world that, even though it should be the first point of change, is not really changing in the ways that we might like to see. And so we have people who are having to go through this world not designed for them, and being punished if they don't respond in those ways. So equipping people with skills to navigate that world does seem to be useful, but also teaching them that this is an option for how you can respond. It's not that you must respond this way no matter what. It's not a mandate for how you have to be, but here's the option. For example, if you're trying to apply for a job and you want interview skills, this might be helpful. And then if you're having a meaningful connection with your friend, maybe not, maybe you don't need the mask in that context because it's safe for you.
Yeah, and that comes back to that context sensitivity a little bit, and allowing, I'm coming up with the word choice. I don't know if that's appropriate, but allowing for that choice within a context, whether we follow a particular rule or whether we follow a different rule. One of the questions I have for you that I didn't send ahead of time, so if you'll forgive me for asking this one, I think we've sort of veered off our original agenda a little bit, but do you have a thought or any thoughts about the connection between the sort of broad idea of flexibility, if you will, and a broad idea of well-being? Speaking to that component of context sensitivity in our behaviors.
I think that they're definitely related. So being able to change what I'm doing if what I'm doing is not working for me would likely increase my well-being, because I'm not stuck then repeating things that are not serving me at all. And at the same time, I need to be able to follow rules to a degree in order to navigate the world effectively and also safely. So finding that midpoint in rule following where we're bending rules when it's useful, we're breaking rules when it's useful, and we're following them when that is something that serves our long-term values or our long-term goals.
Yeah, I believe the literature does support that connection between well-being and, you know, values-driven behavior. So I'm hearing that sort of through line, if you will, in what you shared about, like, I guess we're back to workability, aren't we?
Yep. You know, for who, says who, how do we know? I do think I went on a little bit of a tangent there about the neuroaffirmative pieces. So it might be important for me to say that I've only been involved in those spaces in the past year and a half or so, and it's still something that I'm learning about, incredibly interested in, and also learning more about as I go on. But it is something that can be really useful, especially in terms of that perspective shift, and even in terms of context sensitivity as well.
Yeah, I feel I'm learning all the time as well. from so many others, and hopefully integrating well into practice. If there was something that you would like to leave with us or leave with the audience about our conversation or about rules or about something that they might like to follow up with, what sort of things would you like to leave us with?
Oh, this feels a little bit embarrassing now, and that's okay. I recently, as in I think yesterday, had a paper published that I'm really proud of. And it was working with a group of adolescents to deliver an online ACT intervention. And there were some really unique pieces to that work where we had followed these adolescents for almost 70 days and collected data. And we saw some really powerful shifts in their rule following and also in their well-being as well. So I might encourage people to take a look at that if they're feeling especially nerdy. And if they're not, that's okay too.
And it is in the Journal of Contextual Behavioral Science, having also just looked it up after.
Oh, nice.
So I had seen it, and I have not had the opportunity to read through it yet, but I have. It's literally open on my screen behind my notes here.
Oh, nice. I'm
looking forward to reading it. Thank you so much for joining us. It is such a joy just to hear how thoughtful and attentive you are to all the components that are happening all at once. And there's so much compassion in how you talk about these things. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Please consider checking out the website, www.vigiobx.com, to find more helpful resources from our guests and from other professionals using acceptance and commitment training to support parents and children. You can leave comments or requests on the podcast page, find more information about our guests, and subscribe to our newsletter as well. We have a recommended book list, a blog, and options for a free 30-minute consultation if you're interested in working with us. Go gently and have a great day.